Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his new book, Come Manifesto, Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit, legendary scholar of Islam, Bruce Lawrence, outlines his politico-conceptual manifesto for the study and place of Islam in the modern world. He does so by expounding lyrically and brilliantly on the key category of his book that also forms its title, Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit. Much of the book is devoted to elaborating and nuancing what these three categories mean to Lawrence and their significance to the craft of Islamic studies today. He also delves on some other central themes, such as the notion of Persian cosmopolis and its importance to the manifesto he details in this book. Analytically piercing and refreshingly unhinged, this manifesto should and will be widely read and debated. Here is my conversation with Professor Bruce Lawrence. Hello, Dr. Lawrence. Welcome to the New Books Network. It's fantastic to have you again on the New Books Network on New Books in Islamic Studies, and this time with this really thrilling and interesting new book, Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit. Really looking forward to our conversation today. And I guess I want to begin, Dr. Lawrence, by asking you a broad question, which is, I guess anyone who reads this book realizes that in some ways this book is both a distillation and in some ways an encompassment of your intellectual career. But I want to ask you sort of in the near term, how did you come to write this particular book? What sort of spurred you in the direction to write this book? And the other sort of connected question I want to tag along with this is, the really fascinating thing in terms of the texture of this book, the kind of book it is that I found really fascinating and also really interesting and productive, is that it is at once a rigorous analysis of a set of key concepts in the study of religion and Islam, but it is also, as you mentioned, a manifesto. So I'm wondering, as a writer, how did you strike that balance, which I think you have struck really quite beautifully, between the analytical and the, I guess, the prescriptive or the manifesto part of it? As a writer, how did you strike that balance? I just want to ask this two-part question.
Well, it's a great question. And one of the responses I've gotten from several people who've read it is that this was my second manifesto. And I said, really, I didn't realize that I'd written a previous one. And they said, yes, anybody who reads Who is Allah, the book which I did for University of North Carolina Press in the series that Carl Ernst and I co-edited on Islamic Civilization Muslim Networks. Anybody who reads that realizes that I'm not writing simply a descriptive book or even one that's analytical, but also, in a sense, it is, if you will, a call to rethinking what one means when one uses the very basic term Allah and what different contexts and what different audiences hear about it. So actually, until somebody told me that, to be honest, and I wouldn't want to be anything else with you or with your audience, I think this is actually my second manifesto. And I think the person who read Who is Allah as a manifesto is correct. And I think what both of them have in common is that they take up key terms. Obviously, Allah is one that's very well known and people have heard it everywhere, whether they're Muslim or not. But then the term Islamicate, which is the first word in my newest book and my second manifesto, is a term that's really unknown, except to a very limited audience of people who either specialize in global history or think of Islam and Islamic studies as their purview. So in each case, I'm taking a term which has value and audiences and histories, but trying to turn it and look at it from a critical perspective that expands rather than contracts the audience who will listen and hear what I'm saying in this new book. So I guess Islamic hate goes back, if you will, to Aligarh. I mean, as you may recall from our conversation last January about my own reader and my own life, is that until I went to India and specifically to Aligarh and Aligarh Muslim University in the mid-70s, I thought of myself as a textualist who was going to work in two languages, Arabic and Sanskrit, and occasionally look at Persian. But after going to Aligarh, I realized that there is something much bigger about Persian than even contemporary Iran, that there is something that is Persian in India and resolute through various experiences and persons and events and institutions that are linked to South Asia. So I expanded my world and my worldview in the mid-70s in Aligarh. But then when I came back to the United States, a friend of mine, Richard Martin, who's unfortunately now deceased, but Richard Martin, a longtime colleague who was then at Arizona State, had a conference on Islamic studies in 1980. And everybody was talking about Orientalism. And even then I felt Orientalism is too limited a concept, even though it's debated and still debated and will always be debated about what is meant by it, and especially by the book by Ebert Said in 1978. There's something much more. So when I came to the point 25 years later, when I was thinking about retiring from Duke, some of my colleagues, including our common good friend Ibrahim Musa, had said, well, let's have a conference where we talk about what your ideas are on Islamic studies that are not Orientalism, that are post-Orientalism. So that conference, it was arranged in 2006 and later published as a book, Rethinking Islamic Studies, went from Orientalism to cosmopolitanism. So I found myself linking Islamic and Islamicate to cosmopolitan, but I thought Islamicate was too insider a term, too limited in its knowledge and audience. So I thought instead of doing Muslim cosmopolitanism, and I applied to Blackwell, and they were very excited about doing a manifesto. This is in 2010, a manifesto on Muslim cosmopolitanism. But then I had the experience of teaching for a semester out in Qatar, in Doha, with my spouse and partner Miriam Cook. And both of us were in Doha, and I rekindled my interest in Islamicate and thought again about how could the term Islamicate apply to civilization. So we did a conference there on cosmopolitanism, and the term there was Islamicate cosmopolitanism. And so I rethought it and worked on it when I was also in Indonesia and Southern Philippines on a Carnegie grant. And then I had this experience in 2019 of going to Exeter as a visiting professor at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. And they asked me for an introductory lecture, and I thought, well, I'll try Islamicate cosmopolitan. And then the more I thought about it, I said, no, it's not just Islamicate cosmopolitan, it's Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit. So very briefly, that's the genesis, going back to the mid-70s to the late second decade of the current century to just 3 years ago, when I, at this time 3 years ago, I was at Exeter. I evolved from thinking about Islam to thinking about Muslim cosmopolitan to thinking about Islamicate cosmopolitan, and finally thinking about Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit. The answer to the second part of your question is that, so that's the if you will, the larger trajectory or the time span of how I got interested and how I changed. But what really spurred me to make it analytical rather than narrative, which is the second part of your question, was that there were many people who were challenging the term Islamicate, and of course among them Shahab Ahmed, whom we'll talk about later. But in his book, What is Islam, the Importance of Being Islamic? It was a sense in which he frontally looked at Hodgson's terminology and disagreed with it. And the more I thought about his arguments there, including his quotation of my own work on Hodgson, I found that I needed to make a broader appeal where I accepted the criticisms, because some of his criticism and others' criticism is valid about the narrowness and the presumption of what's meant by Islamic hate, but I felt that new terminology and a fresh way of thinking about Islamic hate was valuable. So I retooled after 2019 and wrote this monograph as an analytic, as you correctly say, not just a narrative or a literary, but an analytic and reflective essay manifesto on why this particular term, I call it ICS, Islamic Hate Cosmopolitan Spirit, is important and I hope of value to many people.
That's a great segue to my next question. You're an author who takes titles very seriously, and there are many very prominent scholars whose books, if you see the acknowledgments, they oftentimes thank you for the suggestions you made on their titles, and they became really important books in our field. But I think if there was any book in which the title is really, really central to the book itself, it's this one, because in some ways, this book is a reflection on the three categories that make up the title: Islamic Hate, Cosmopolitan, and then Spirit. So I want to spend some time, for the benefit of the listener, on each of these terms and how you talk about them and how you explain and elaborate on them throughout the book. And I want to begin with the category that you just mentioned, Islamic Hate. And walk us through, Dr. Lawrence, if you will, the sort of ways in which you try to not only retool, but also launch a defense of sorts of Islamic Hate. And you correctly mentioned, and you mentioned in the book also, that there have been many critiques of this term, most prominently perhaps in the work of the late Shahab Ahmed. So tell us a bit about what you find these critiques to be missing about the effectiveness, the durability, the importance of this category, and what animates your insistence on the productivity of this category, both as an analytical tool and also in terms of the political work that it does in terms of thinking about Islam today.
Well, I'm so glad that you pieced together the analytical and the political, because what I try to do in the beginning, but also in the other parts and finally in the conclusion of this manifesto on Islamic Hate, Cosmopolitan Spirit, or ICS, is I acknowledge that the term comes from Hodgson, but that Hodgson's coined this term back in the 1960s. Of course, his book wasn't published until posthumously in 1974, The Venture of Islam, Conscience and History in a World Civilization. And obviously, Hodgson coined the term, so I refer to him and I have elaborate discussion of what he meant and how others have thought about what he meant in the use of the term Islamic Hate. But what I'm constantly trying to do is to realize that those two terms, Muslim and Islamic, which many people take for granted when they think about that part of the world from Senegal to Indonesia, but also now parts of Europe and North America, Western Europe and North America, that include large segments of Muslim population, but also influences from a larger culture and civilization that is linked to Islam, that the great difficulty is that people identify the religion with the civilization, or they merge religion and culture. And what the late Shahab Ahmed did was to say that Hodgson, in using the term Islamic Hate, is accenting the cultural over the religious, and in fact, making the cultural something that is secular and the religious something that is only related to personal faith. So that he really discredits, as many people do, discredit Hodgson's neologism, because Hodgson invented this, first of all, as somebody who was a Western scholar, somebody who's born in North America and lived, except for one really important year of his life, which most people don't recognize, that Hodgson, after he got his PhD, spent, I think, the most important and significant year of his life in the same place where I spent 2 years of my life. That's Aligarh Muslim University. Hodgson was there from 1950 to 1951. And I think that year in Aligarh changed the way he thought about the Muslim world and also about the nature of what pertains to Islam in the cultural and social and political, as well as the religious and personal and faith-oriented domain. So yes, Hodgson was American, Protestant, Quaker in his background, but I think he was broadly universal in his outlook and very probing and constantly searching for new ways to think about what was it that was distinctive about Islam and Islamic civilization. And he realized that the term Islamic, too often gets circled back not only to religion, but to Arab and Arabic. So I just want to mention something which some of your listeners will recognize, is that there is a center, an institute in England called the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies, which is where I taught for a semester in early 2019. And it's a wonderful place to go and pursue the study of Islam. But the number of people who refer to it not as the Center of Arab and Islamic Studies, but the Center of Arabic and Islamic Studies. They use the qualifier for the language rather than the qualifier for the larger group of people and places that are known as Arab. And so this difficulty that is even there in the present day in 2019, as recently as 3 years ago, when I would say to people, oh, I'm at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies, they said, oh, so you're doing Arabic studies. I said, no, Arab studies. So this constant association of Islamic with Arabic and the intertwining, not just in the origin, but in the development of it. So Hodgson, the reason why I take Islamicate seriously and use it as the first word in my manifesto, is Islamicate really implies that there is what Hodgson called a Perso-Arabic or an Irano-Semitic, that there's something that's larger than Arabic. It's not to discount or say that Arabic isn't important, but that Arabic and Arab by itself does not explain what's Islamic. So I think it was this puzzle on how to expand, not to limit or narrow or somehow reduce the importance of Islamic or Muslim or Arab, but to show that there is a larger civilization, what he calls a world civilization based on conscience and history that describes Islam. And so the venture of Islam is really the venture, not just of the whole history, which he outlines in a unique way in his three volumes, the venture of Islam, but also the venture of understanding it, of looking imaginatively and thoughtfully and crucially at all the dimensions of what characterizes this massive civilization that really for him begins even before the arrival of the Prophet Muhammad, because it has elements in the pre-Islamic world that then become important with the spread of Islam and with the development of what he calls Islamicate civilization. So to answer your question, I take my cue from Hodgson, but also accept the critique of Shahab Ahmed, also the critique more recently, which I know you're familiar with from our common resource, Armando Salvatore, who now teaches at McGill, with whom I've had lots of correspondence, but never had the privilege of meeting. But Salvatore, in this wonderful book where you're also a contributor, which also comes out from Wiley Blackwell, and they're not paying me to say this, but I'll say it anyway, that the Wiley Blackwell History of Islam is a remarkable work. As much as I try and reduce everything to talk about Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit in a single slim volume, this is an expanded, huge book. I think it's almost 700 pages, which comes out from Wiley Blackwell in 2018, about 4 years ago. And it's remarkable because it's the only history, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the only major history of Islam that I have read or of which I'm aware that actually tries to apply Hodgsonian categories to the entire span of Islam from the pre-modern to the modern and looking into the future. So even while I applaud Salvatore for this wonderful volume and especially enjoy the chapter 25 in the seventh act, where you have a wonderful chapter on modernity and how you think about modernity with reference to the great Western transmutation Islam that Hodgson talks about, I still think that there's a sense in which Armando Salvatore, like Shahab Ahmed, like others, mistakes what Hodgson means by Islamicate by calling it secular. So I know that you're aware of this, but other people may not be aware that, like many things, Salvatore co-edits and co-authors, and he co-authored an essay in, I believe it was 2019, which he described Islamicate secularities. And by pinning Islamicate with secular, you've already pigeonholed, and I think misshapen, what Hodgson intended, what I think is the higher role of Islamicate, which is to break beyond binaries. So my constant effort throughout this book is to go beyond binaries of thinking of Islam and the West, or Arab and Persian, as always oppositional and not just simply complementary items. So I think that the word Islamicate for me should be an envelope, not a dead end, in thinking about how one goes beyond religion and goes beyond culture and thinks about categories that combine religion and culture that are expansive rather than narrowing and that don't include secular and religious as oppositional, but include cultural and religious as compatible. So that's why I use the term Islamicate, referencing Hodgson, but not limiting him, and acknowledging the critiques of Shahab Ahmed, but also Armando Salvatore in thinking about it.
Just as a quick follow-up, so in some ways, one might sort of distill your argument in that you're trying to show that one cannot bifurcate these two categories of religion and culture, which can then be mapped onto this bifurcation between the religious and the secular, but rather they're so enmeshed in Hodgson's thought and also in terms of how you think about the Islamicate that both sort of cross-pollinate with each other. Would that be sort of an accurate way to talk about your defense of Islamicate?
Yes, and I think the word that's missing, which I have hesitated to use until now, but I have to introduce it, is if one wants to look, first of all, if one accepts civilization as a category of analysis, which I do. So you know, when I begin my book, I talk about Islamicate, but before I talk about cosmopolitan, I talk about civilization, because I don't believe one can use or invoke the term cosmopolitan without thinking of civilization. So I talk about Islamicate civilization, which of course is Hodgson's term, and both you and Salvatore and some others have correctly said that the shorthand for Islamicate civilization might be Islamicate ecumene, which is another term Hodgson uses, the Afro-Eurasian, or Islamicate ecumene, and that another word would be Islamdom. And so I talk a lot about how all these neologisms, Islamicate, Islamdom, Afro-Eurasian or Eurasian, ecumene, all these things are important to think about the way in which history has expanded since the 6th century and that what's happened with those parts of Afro-Asia that have become Muslim is that there is obviously a perpetuation of loyalty to Islam and the development of Islam as religion, but there's also a larger cultural wing. I say larger because it includes religion but doesn't limit it to a faith allegiance or even institutional memory that's defined by religion, but instead includes a cultural arc that goes into different forms of science, different forms of art, different forms of music and literary expression that, yes, are linked to religion, but not limited to the articulation or profession of a single faith outlook. So I believe that, yes, one can't bifurcate, but it's really difficult to aggregate. Instead of bifurcating, to aggregate concepts which in English, like religion and culture, are taken to be conflicting or at least competitive, and to combine them and say there's something that goes beyond the competition that is in the conflation or convergence of religion and culture, and that is the cosmopolitan spirit that Hodgson defines as Islamicate.
Let's move to the next key term of the title. In fact, you take on cosmopolitan and spirit separately, but let's try to combine the two. You might allow that. Tell us a bit about, I mean, this is, of course, a category which is oftentimes used in very different contexts and ways. Tell us a bit about how you employ this category of the cosmopolitan spirit, and how does it connect with this first category of the Islamicate? Why is it so important to connect Islamicate with this idea of cosmopolitan spirit?
Well, I appreciate the question, and if Islamicate is not well known, and if I'm trying to reintroduce it or revitalize it for a larger audience within the academy, but above all in the academy and Islamic studies, and we can talk about that more later, the term cosmopolitan has almost been too well known. It's something that has been thought about in endless conversations, and even in going back to the work that I did in 2006 and the book Rethinking Islamic Studies in 2010 that my two colleagues, Carl Ernst and Richard Martin, published, and also a wonderful essay in there from my other former colleague, Ibrahim Musa, that all those works, instead of talking about it, Islamic studies from Orientalism to post-structuralism or post-modernism or post-anythingism, I really thought that the more important thing was to think about Islamic studies in a cosmopolitan vein. And what is cosmopolitan about Islam and is not merely the religion and the various episodes and dimensions of Islamic identity that one could talk about and should talk about in thinking about the larger history of Islam, but there's also something cosmopolitan that includes religion along with cultural influences and cultural elements that are not strictly speaking secular, but also can't be defined only by religion. So for me, cosmopolitan is an important concept because it allows one to think more broadly about what is Islamic and what is Muslim in a idiom with a political twist to it, because cosmopolitan means going beyond nationalist or regional definitions of East or West or North or South or America versus the rest, which is something that too many people take seriously. And cosmopolitan implies, and I think it goes to my point of using it as a manifesto rather than a long and deep detailed gauge history, is to say that cosmopolitan is what Riverbend described as having enough faith in your own conviction and your own background that you can accept the faith in the background of others. And so this is not a deeply historical take. Riverbend is just a blog name of somebody who was really talking about the Iraq War and its aftermath. But I think Riverbend's shibboleth is that the civilization is really having enough security in your own faith and culture to allow people the sanctity of theirs. It combines sanctity, is a word usually used for religion. So in Riverbend, it's combining one's own outlook and one's own deepest loyalties with an appreciation for other people and the sanctity. I think that term is very important, the sanctity, that is the separateness and the esteem of their own culture background. So for me, cosmopolitan means not my way or the highway. It doesn't mean having something that is sometimes talked about as a nice way of having tea and associating with people who have lots of money and can travel anywhere. Cosmopolitan is not just something that is used as a way of proclaiming you're better than other people, but cosmopolitan is really a deeper, more important way of identifying with all parts of the world and with accepting the faith and the culture of others, and not simply doing what I think I quoted somebody from the New York Times said is an order of meritocracy where you you simply call yourself a global citizen because you have enough wealth to travel and do things that other people can't do. So I'm trying to broaden not only Islam and Muslim to think about it in another idiom that's called Islamicate, but also saying that cosmopolitan, and above all the cosmopolitan spirit, is something that animates Islam. And just to refer to Shahab Ahmed again one more time, when he has a dedication of his book, he talks about his parents as those who taught him the cosmopolitan of Islam and the Islam of their cosmopolitanism. And what's ironic in his book, it's a wonderful book and has wonderful many insights that I could talk about as readily as I could talk about my own recent manifesto, but he never really defines what's cosmopolitan. And so for me, cosmopolitan is exactly the key word to have side by side in conjuncture and in development and explication of what is meant by Islamicate. And both terms, Islamicate and cosmopolitan, anticipate the third term which I use, which is spirit.
And do you want to explicate a bit about where you take the word spirit?
Sure. Spirit, I have to say, is something that came to me late. If I thought a lot about Islamicate, which I clearly have, and I became introduced to cosmopolitan going back at least to 15, 20 years ago, the whole emphasis on spirit really came from my engagement with M.F. Hussein and with trying to think through what made his art so extraordinary and why, for those people who don't know him, somebody who was a scholar identified with India as a Muslim who had radically modern or modernist views and eventually had to go in exile because he confronted and affronted some of the more extreme Hindu or Hindutva citizens and then later rulers of India in trying to come to terms with and appreciate not only the art, but the intellectual scope of M.F. Hussein, I realized that what really described him was something which I call fuzzy logic. And I was invited to write an essay on M.F. Hussein for a volume on fuzzy logic, and realized it was exactly this idea of logic, fuzzy logic or Barzakh logic, that defined him. And it's, again, going back to what I think is the crucial element of Islamicate and the core of cosmopolitan identity, is not to deny twos, but not to view twos as always confrontational, but also sometimes agonistic rather than antagonistic, as connecting rather than opposing each other. So I think of Barzakh, you know what it is, but many people who are listening or thinking about it may not know. Barzakh is a term which, surprising to many people, is a Persian word found in the Quran. So nobody has ever argued that it's an Arabic word, but it has an Arabic association because it's in the Arabic Quran. But Barzakh is a term which almost embodies in itself the double nature of Islam, Muslim, Islamicate. It refers in the Quran to both this world and the next world, but also refers to divide between salt and fresh water. And I've often talked with biologists about this and said, you know, how do you think about this difference? And they said, we've never explained it, but there are different places in the world where salt and fresh water combine, but there's a space between them, which is neither salt nor fresh, but allows each of them to be in conversation or connection to each other. So this is actually mentioned in the Quran, and I take this to be a wonderful metaphor with a scientific basis. So it's not just something that's another kind of imaginative idea without a historical or empirical grounding. So there actually is something that is observable as a binary dualism that is not, however, a strict dualism, but a dyad. So it's both and rather than either or neither or. So I think this is the way of thinking about spirit. Is a spirit is something which allows one to think through contrasts, and without seeing them as contradictories, to see the ways in which they merge with each other, and the way in which Persian and Arabic became Perso-Arabic and Urano and Semitic became an element of what developed as Islamicate civilization. So for me, spirit is the animation. Some people said to me, why didn't you use the word ethos? I could have used the word ethos because ethos refers to the ethical dimension of spirit, which is crucial to it, and I argue that in my book. But I think spirit is a larger animating concept, and it's also something which is not fixed by a single denotation as being ethics or politics or society or literature. Spirit is something which animates without itself being fully located or limited to one place or one analytical metaphor.
Now, you provide several examples in one of the chapters of the book of the figures in both pre-modern and modern, as well as contemporary figures, including M.F. Hussein, whom you already have talked about, as figures who really exemplify this ICS, the Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit. We won't have the time to talk about each and every of the fascinating figures and their sort of intellectual strivings that you detail in the book. But perhaps if I could ask you to maybe choose a couple from the various figures you outline and share with our listeners a bit why you find those two figures to really exemplify the central category that is the subject of the book.
You know, I really appreciate your questions. And I must say, when you told me in advance that you were going to be asking me certain questions, and this was one of them, I said to my wife, to Miriam Cook, I said, you know, all these questions are good and all of them have several answers, but this is probably the toughest. So I'm going to admit that when I looked at all your questions and I thought, which are the ones that I'm going to really have to hesitate, I hope not stumble, but at least linger and look and listen for a minute before I think about what I can say. So I actually reread the monograph to see what else I could say about two different figures. And I found myself going back and forth saying, if I pick these two, I haven't done these. If I think about these, what about these others? So I must say this was the most challenging of all your questions because I found it, frankly, very hard to limit myself to two, because each one of the ones, what your question forced me to do was to say, why had I picked certain people? And why do I think certain people are really important? So I'm going to do something which is because you were kind enough to give me these questions in advance and I was able to think about it, I really thought long and hard and said, there's a certain sense in which I really can't answer the question adequately, so how can I answer it even with some attention to the subtlety that you're requesting? And so I think you're really, the two people who I'm going to mention are as opposite as, and probably it's the only book that anybody will read where the two of them are in the same cluster of pages between the cover and the front cover and the back cover of a single book. So the first person is somebody that everybody has heard of or at least heard about, and that's Ibn Khaldun. So I don't think I could say there's two people and exclude Ibn Khaldun from one of the two. And there are several reasons for this. One is, I mentioned my own biography, but I didn't say that when I was a graduate student, which I was decades ago now, not just years ago, but decades ago, I studied with somebody who is known as an Orientalist, but often described as an enlightened or at least Orientalist light scholar, and that was Franz Rosenthal. And Franz Rosenthal is best known for his translation of the Muqaddima of Ibn Khaldun. And he required those of us who were his graduate students when I was there back in the late 60s to read almost all of Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddimah, which he was then in the process of translating and finishing his translation for Princeton University Press. So I was really taken with Ibn Khaldun, but I was also aware that this was such an arcane Arabic that nobody would ever read it, nobody would ever take it seriously beyond graduate school. So I kind of parked Ibn Khaldun upstairs. I thought of him as interesting. And then, of course, once I rediscovered Hodgson, I'd heard of Hodgson, but never read him until after I came back from Aligarh in 1976. His book had been published in 74, and I didn't read it 2 years later. I found him describing Ibn Khaldun as the forerunner and the foremost figure in Islamic Age civilization. So there I found it. Ibn Khaldun was linked not only to Hodgson, but as a forerunner and the foremost person who had formulated Islamic Age civilization. So I went back and reread Ibn Khaldun, and many years later found myself, in fact, in the past decade, teaching at an institute in Istanbul that's called the Alliance for Civilizations, but it's located within a larger university called Ibn Khaldun University. So Ibn Khaldun has been there from my graduate school days till my retirement from Duke and my continued teaching in Istanbul as a liminal and formidable figure, a liminal insight and a formidable scholar. So I cannot talk about Islamic Age cosmopolitan spirit and talk about an exemplar without Ibn Khaldun. But I have to quickly add that civilization itself has become a debated term. I went to Yale Law School back in the fall of 2018 for a conference honoring Hodgson on the 50th anniversary of his death. He died in 68, and this conference was in 2018, so it was exactly 50 years after his demise. And several people there had different takes on Hodgson, and not all of them agreed with him, and some of them openly attacked him. But one of the things that was really most interesting was that some people said, oh, you can't fault Hodgson because he was a child of the 60s, and he thought civilization was important, but now we know that civilization is just another Western category. So there is a strong element, and these are some very fine historians, I'm not going to mention any by name, who think of civilization as something outdated, as something prejudicial, as something that reflects, in Ebrar Said's terms, an Orientalist bias, and that civilization itself has to be bypassed if one is to think about it in an accurate way, a history of the Muslim world. So, for instance, there is an edited work from OUP, Oxford University Press, which I don't discuss in my monograph because it would have taken me even further afield. But it's by a sociologist named Lutfi Sunar called Debates on Civilization in the Muslim World. And what it shows, in effect, is that there is no real connection between the social science of the 19th and 20th and now the 21st centuries and any real understanding of the deep roots of the Muslim past or what could be called Islamic Age civilization. So the idea of civilization itself is dismissed as something that is only Western. Now, when I read and reread and teach, as I have taught Ibn Khaldun for years now. The whole idea, he does have a binary. Of course he has a binary between Umr al-Madawi and Umr al-Hadari. So there are two different Umrans. But Umran itself is a category which is only translated as civilization. There's no other, I've looked in every even in other terms where they try to translate it, they say Umran finally comes back down to civilization. This is not original. It may, to put it in different terms, Hodgson may have rediscovered, but he wasn't the first to rediscover Ibn Khaldun. Toynbee had already thought that Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddimah was a giant work. But just because Western scholars who are interested in civilization theory rediscovered and deployed Ibn Khaldun in their own ways does not mean that his notion of civilization is itself outdated. And Farid al-Attas, who teaches at NUS and who's written extensively about Ibn Khaldun, notes that his idea of Umran can only loosely be translated as civilization because it really is an encompassing category of social order. So if you wanted to think about it, it's two notions of social order. One of that's Hadari, which is civilized, if you will, or urban, and the other, which is Bedouin or rustic or rural or outside, but it's not barbaric. The term barbaric and savage, which get introduced and compared with civilization, only comes in Western culture. So I think, to go back to your question, Ibn Khaldun has to be held up, as he is in my book, as one of the exemplars of not just Islamic cosmopolitan spirit, but a notion of civilization that transcends a Western-Eastern binary, where if the West uses or misuses or tries to think of civilization as only Western, or Western civilization as the dominant force in global history, that has to be challenged, but not at the risk and not at the cost of eliminating Ibn Khaldun as the forefather. He's the forefather of many things, but he is above all the forefather of civilization studies. So he has to be there, and he is there as one of my top two. And my other one is the opposite end, and it's going to surprise you and probably surprise most listeners, is somebody that they've never heard of, and they can only read about secondarily because he left this world very young. He left this world as somebody who was assassinated in February 2013 at the age of 36, and his name is Albert Husin. And Albert Husin is a Mindanaoan, larger Filipino Muslim, whom I got to know when I was doing research in the southern Philippines in Mindanao over 10 years ago. And he helped me to understand many ways in which there is a genuine cosmopolitan that's a local cosmopolitan, not something that you can put into words, but something that is rooted in the experience and the culture of people in what I call loosely Islam Nusantara, that Islam that's out in the larger reaches of the Indian Ocean. And a good part of my book, and I think probably the part that will endure after people have criticized me, as they've criticized Hodgson and others for use of the term Islamicate, is that there is a Persianate domain, a domain of Persian influence, which is not limited to the Persian language or even Persian culture, but rather to the diffusion of a kind of local idiom of cosmopolitan identity. And that local idiom can be in Persian, but it can also be in Urdu, it can be in Bahasa Indonesia or Malay in Bahasa, or it can be in one of the several languages of the southern Philippines. So in a sense, if one's talking about a kind of local cosmopolitan ethic, that the Persianate idiom, which I try to express and to develop in the latter part of this manifesto, is really summarized in this person, Albert Husin. And the reason I mention him, and he's not somebody who's got a great book, as Ibn Khaldun has a great book identified with him, or a great range of art associated with him, which M.F. Hussein does, nor is he somebody like some of the women whom I mentioned this, who are well-known in their own right, even when they're attacked, they're well-known for the art that they've represented and the scholarship that stands behind that art. This fellow never wrote anything that you could get this published. You could never find out much about him. But through his friend who introduced me to him, Joel Kennedy, who's now a scholar in his own right teaching in Manila, because I was able to find out so much about the local rooted cosmopolitan, what I call the rooted cosmopolitanism of southern Philippines through him, I would rank him as one of the two great Islamic cosmopolitan spirits whom I've been privileged to know and whom I would put next to Ibn Khaldun as the two most important people in my book.
Terrific. My next question actually comes from this category that you've already talked about just now, which is another major category of this book, especially its latter half, which is the idea of the Persianate. And you often also talk in this book about this category that other scholars have also mentioned, the Persianate Cosmopolis. So again, this is the kind of book that I think is best analyzed by dissecting and really spending some time with the key categories that that populate it. So again, why is this category, the Persianate, central to your manifesto? And I also want you to perhaps take a step back from this particular book and share some reflections with us about why this category has been so central in terms of shaping the trajectory of your own scholarship. You mentioned you began primarily with Arabic and Sanskrit and with your work on Ashadistan, etc. But of course, as your career progressed, the Persianate became perhaps the major category of analysis or the sort of your research arc. So perhaps a two-part question. Why is it central to the manifesto, and how did it end up taking such a major place in your own research?
Well, I could say that one of the things that was most challenging and also most beneficial for me in my life was to get tenure so early that I realized once I was tenured that now that I had a job for life, I had to learn what to teach. So my own very short biography is that when I began, as I said, I thought that the only two languages I needed to know in order to have a productive scholarly life were Sanskrit and Arabic. And those are the two languages in which I focused and focused intensely during my 4 years as a grad student at Yale. But what I discovered after I was lucky enough to get tenure at an early age, at an early stage in my career, I was able to apply for and to get a scholarship to go to India and to go to Aligarh Muslim University, where I was associated, as was Hodgson, with the history department. He was there in 1951, and I was there in 64 to 66. And what I discovered during the time that I was in Aligarh was not only is there a vibrant intellectual community of Muslims in South Asia, but also that the language which was used in pre-modern times and which animated a lot of scholarship was Persian. And so for the 2 years that I was in India, I was able to be tutored by Vardis Kirmani, who was in the Persian department at AMU or Aligarh Muslim University. And I was also able to learn enough Urdu to pass in the Dhodpur market and other places in South Asia where Urdu was spoken. But I really developed a deep appreciation for Persian and above all for Persian poetry and Persian key terms. So it was really the experience of post-tenure recognition that I had only begun to learn and not learned enough to know what I wanted to teach and how I wanted to explore topics as a scholar. So Persian became a language which I used a lot when I was in Aligarh and have used a lot in my scholarship since. When some people ask me what are my serious books, I say, well, I can mention several, and you yourself have talked about Defenders of God, and now people can talk about this as another kind of, or Who is Allah, as serious books that are both a manifesto and also a larger analytical survey. But I would say my happiest book is probably the translation I did of the Malfazat of Sheikh Nizamuddin Awliya called Fuad al-Fuad, which I categorized and translated as Morals for the Heart. So ever since diving deeply into thinking about the Persian language, Persian literature, Indo-Persian Sufism, as I did during the 2 years in Aligarh and have done in several trips and several activities since then, I've recognized that Persian is not only the equivalent of Arabic, but really in terms of Islamic age civilization, it's equal. It's not only equivalent in terms of having anything, but it's equal in terms of the influence it's had in the larger world of Islamic age civilization. So I think when someone asked me, what is the most important, one of the people who read this book asked me, what is the most important chapter? I said, well, the one that probably is the most definitive is the one that's number 5, Persianate Culture Across the Indian Ocean, where I explain how the two terms that Hodgson originates, Islamicate and Persianate, are in tandem, but that if one had to choose one in terms of cultural impact, one would say that Persianate is the greater because it has a sense of going as a expression of cultural norms that imply Islam but exceed Islam in terms of their relatedness to large cultures that are under Muslim rule. So Persian and the Persian cosmopolis, Dick Eaton talks about with reference to his longstanding discussion of the notion of Sheldon Pollack's Sanskrit cosmopolis. Dick Eaton counterposes a Persian cosmopolis. And Dick is a good friend. For those of the listeners who don't know him, I would say that, you know, his book, India and the Persianate Age, is a wonderful insight into how Persian and Persian language, but also Persian norms of, and especially Persian norms of conduct, are important in thinking about South Asia from 1000 to 1750. My only qualm with Dick was that he never mentions Hodgson and never mentions that the Persianate is intertwined with Islamicate. So my own take is that Persianate and Islamicate are separate, but that one really can't understand the longer impact, the longer range impact and influence of Persianate without seeing that it's also linked to and resonant as a form of an expression of an Islamicate spirit or an Islamicate ethos. So in terms of how I use it in this book, I try in chapter 5 on, where I talk about Persianate culture beyond the Nile Doxus and beyond the early spheres that Hodgson describes. I talk about it across the Indian Ocean, which is something he dealt with, but only partially, and many people feel he dealt with it inadequately, which I would say, yes, I agree, he did only deal partially with Southeast Asia and not nearly enough with the oceans and the ocean connect element of the Indian Ocean. But still, there is the possibility, there is the element of a craft in the making of an embryo, if you will, in how he talks about the Indian Ocean as a Persianate zone. So for me, the word that symbolizes this, because everybody needs to have one word, the one word is adab. And I use adab repeatedly in the book, knowing that there are certain people who don't know any Arabic or any Persian who will say, that's just another way of ducking responsibility. So to show that I have read other people who've thought about this, I quote our common resource, Amanda Salvatore, who describes adab as rules of courtly behavior inspired by a sense of what is proper and beautiful. So I think that this term of what is proper and beautiful is a wonderful way of saying, a very apt way of suggesting that adab is not just about doing something well, it's doing something that's beautiful. And so the word ihsan, which is often linked to adab, correctly so, means that one, in one sense, both what is good and what is beautiful, and the two are inseparable. So when I think about Persian and think about how it has helped me, and I hope helped others, think about what is Islam and what is the larger range of Islamdom, or as you've also noted, Islamdom, which also can be Islamicate civilization, that the terms barzakh, which means another Persian word, which means two things that are conjoined, but neither one eliminates or even attempts to eradicate or reduce the other. Two conjoined equivalents, and then also to think about adab as the way in which that's best expressed.
Towards the end of the book, you do a very fascinating analysis where you, in some ways, analyze the place of the Islamicate today in the Western Academy, especially, but not just Western Academy, I would say the broader Euro-American and, I guess, Muslim academies around the world as well, in terms of the place of the Islamicate, how is the Islamicate is faring in some ways in terms of its valences and the different uses that it's been put towards. So tell our listeners a bit about how you evaluate where the Islamicate lies today, or this broader category of the Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit, in terms of the kinds of scholarship which are being produced, the kinds of forums that are happening. So tell us a bit about what is your take on the place of the Islamicate and its efficacy in Euro-American and more broadly the global academy.
Well, it's a wonderful question, and it's a question that I've pondered repeatedly. And what I say in the end of the book, which is something that only really came to me after I had my time at Exeter, and also had, first of all, had the experience, which was a wonderful experience, of the Hodgson celebration at Yale Law School, where several people, including Carol Hillebrand, gave papers about the nature of and Carol was there with her husband, and many people know Robert Hillebrand is also a major Islamic art historian. Both Carol and Robert and also other people at that Yale Law School conference said that they appreciated, you know, Hodgson's influence, and they were there, of course, in a conference to honor the 50-year marking of his death. But they also said, you know, that it's really hard to apply his categories to art. And the more I thought about their challenge, and then somebody pointed out to me that there was this book by Stanford Shaw's daughter, Wendy Shaw, who herself is an Islamicate art historian. But the title of her book is What is Islamic Art? But Islamic is put in sanitary paps. And so my argument, and this is my principal hope, if I could say what I wanted to achieve with this monograph and with this manifesto, is to get people to rethink art and humanities more generally. Because I myself am a visual person, I don't think you can dismiss art and say, well, it's just something different. It's for people who like to draw and think about others who draw or paint or sculpture. I think art is central to any definition of culture and any history of civilization. So for Hodgson to have a lasting impact, there has to be an Islamicate art history. And what happens in this wonderful book, and I can't say enough good things about most of the elements of this book by Wendy Shaw called What is Islamic Art? The difficulty with it is that at the very outset, she says there ought to be a term that's better than Islamic, and there should be a term in Western art, which would probably be Christianate. But she says Christianate is something which underscores the European Christianity as a culture permeated secular Western societies as a measure for assimilation of those designated as other. Well, I think the same thing can be said of Islamicate, that Islamicate art is something where Islam as a faith and as a tradition and as a juridical as well as a philosophical and social norm was upheld, but there is an extra, there is what I call an additive supplement to it. And that supplement is something that Hodgson tries to capture in Islamicate. So if one wants another label, and our common resource, Armando Salvatore, keeps saying there will be better labels ahead, but nobody has found a better label. So until one gets a better label than Islamicate, one has to talk about a broad spectrum of Islamicate influence, which I would call Islamicate cosmopolitan spirit, but specifically in the academy, something that's called Islamicate art. So I think that the crucial notion is that many more people in the academy, but it's beginning with, and especially those in art history, and I mentioned several people who are both pro and anti using the term Islamicate to refer to history in the larger Muslim world, art history in the larger Muslim world. But I feel that it's really important that all branches of the academy, but especially those in the humanities, philosophy I mentioned is one where it seems to be taking hold, certain parts of history is taking hold. But in my argument, in my own sense of history, if one does not include finally art history, the effort to deeper, what Niall Green, whom I haven't mentioned, but who volume I like, he wants to deprovincialize the Persianate world. If it wants to deprovincialize the Islamicate world, one needs to kind of look at broader categories. And I think Islamicate art is one of them.
So as we're coming towards the end of our time, Dr. Lawrence, could you share with our listeners a bit about what keeps you occupied these days in terms of what you're working on? What we might be talking about next January?
Well, next January, I would like to think that I'd be talking about two books. I've been working on two books almost as long as I've been working on these, but I've been working on them with co-authors and with multiple contributors. Well, not with multiple contributors. The one that I've been working on, Riley Blackwell. If there could be a trilogy for Riley Blackwell, of course, the one that you were a part of would be one part on the Armando Salvatore did with two other editors, with Roberto Totoli and Babak Rahimi. So there's the Wadi Blackwell History of Islam, and now there's this Wadi Blackwell manifesto of mine on Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit. But I hope there will be, and I should say this is a very large, inshallah, by next year this time, there should be the Wadi Blackwell Companion of Islamic Spirituality, which I've been working on since 2011, for over 10 years now, with my colleague Vincent Cornell. And it's not his problem or his fault, but there have been several difficulties. The 28 chapters, and I'm sure if I were to sit down and have a workshop with Salvatore and his co-editors, they would say, well, you can't believe how tough it was to get this chapter or how we had to wrestle with this part of it. And so we have just had difficulty. I don't mind mentioning one difficulty, which everybody would understand, is one of the people who contributed to this, contributed as a scholar, and now he's become a politician again. And that's Ali Alawi, who is now the vice premier of Iraq, in charge, and the minister of finance. So when he contributed his initial article to us, he was just a mere scholar at the National University of Singapore. So we have the difficulty of not only making sure that his article is still up to date in terms of what it says, but getting hold of somebody who is busy with things other than academic exercises or articles or publications as part of his life. So I'm hopeful that we can wrestle with the dilemma and the difficulty of Ali Alawi in our volume, but also get the whole thing finished and then published from Wadi Blackwell by next year. And then if that happens, you'll have to have a discussion with both me and with Professor Cornell. But that would be my hope, is that if we can't do it in January, we can do it in February, but we could do it in spring of 2023.
Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit by Professor Bruce Lawrence, published by Wiley Blackwell as part of their Wiley Blackwell Manifestos series. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lawrence. This was just such a great treat to hear you talk about this book, and I'm sure this book will create some fascinating discussion.
Well, I think the treat is mine for your having done this and having...
You're very kind. Thank you so much, Dr. Lawrence, for your time. Thank you so much. So this was my conversation with Professor Bruce Lawrence about his wonderful new book, Islamicate Cosmopolitan Spirit. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. And I also hope you will join us again for another fresh episode of NBIS. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.